the political level, let's say it was a tie. On the moral level, we lost.
Even the accusation of genocide is shocking. That's what Israel has faced at the International Court of Justice. While that matter isn't settled, today the court had something to say to the world about the Gaza conflict. And Israel leveled a shocking accusation of its own against a UN agency, prompting the UN to fire some of its employees and Canada to pause its funding. Welcome to The World at Six. I'm Tom Harrington. Also on the program.
These are sensitive areas. We are concerned.
A ruling in an environmental fight in Quebec. It's about tearing down trees to put up a plant. We also bring you BC's crackdown on smartphones and the struggle to free up enough space for people who can't get enough pickleball. Like the conflict itself, the court ruling is complex, with both sides claiming small victories and losses. The International Court of Justice says Israel must take steps to prevent acts of genocide in Gaza. But the South African legal team behind the case also demanded a ceasefire, something the court refused to order. We have reaction to the ruling from inside Israel, Gaza, and here at home. Chris Brown begins our coverage from Jerusalem.
In The Hague, protesters and supporters of both Israel and Palestinians set the stage for the momentous ruling by the United Nations top court. Lawyers for Israel had wanted what they called the absurd genocide case dismissed, while South Africa's legal team demanded what amounted to a ceasefire in Gaza.
The court considers that
the 15 judges did neither. They ruled that while some of Israel's acts in Gaza could plausibly amount to genocide, the court did not order a halt to the war. Instead, Judge Joan Donoghue said Israel must take actions to prevent acts of genocide and to improve the humanitarian situation.
The court further considers that Israel must ensure with immediate effect that its military forces do not commit any of the aforementioned acts.
Outside, Palestinian Minister Ammar Hijazi said he interpreted the ruling as a win.
This is a good day for humanity.
In Gaza, though, where the fighting is some of the heaviest of the war, and where Palestinian officials say 26,000 people are now dead, half of them women and children, there was disappointment. Immediately, there should have been a ceasefire. Ayad Saeed told a videographer working for CBC News, then they can start investigating and see what's really happening here. Everyone's expecting that Israel won't follow through with the ruling, said Omar al-Saka. Since when has Israel followed through with any ruling from the UN? Israeli officials, including UN Ambassador Gilad Erdan, meanwhile lashed out over the fact that the genocide accusation is still hanging over the country.
Today, the UN has become one of the weapons in the arsenal of modern-day Nazis against us. Every UN body has become weaponized against the Jewish state.
A statement from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu didn't specify if Israel intends to follow the court's orders.
We will continue to do what is necessary to defend our country and defend our people.
In Jerusalem, there's still strong support for the war and concern for the more than 130 hostages being held in Gaza. Some feel the ruling won't change much.
There's genocide going all around the world that everybody's ignoring. The international community is only focusing on Israel, and Israel is the only country that's not committing genocide. They're protecting themselves.
On the political level, let's say it was a tie. On the moral level, we lost.
Alon Liel is a former Israeli ambassador to South Africa.
But in soccer, there is such a thing like yellow card. And our team got 6 yellow cards. They said, for instance, that they are waiting for a report in a month. Let's see if the court convenes in a month and checks the data on a month, especially on the 6 yellow cards.
The ICJ has no means to enforce the ruling, but it can still carry symbolic weight and potentially cause problems internationally for Israel by increasing diplomatic isolation or fueling calls for boycotts or embargoes. Chris Brown, CBC News, Jerusalem.
Interpretations of the ruling here at home also depend on whom you ask. Some argue the scrutiny on Israel will help protect civilians in Gaza, while others say the case shouldn't even be taken seriously. In Ottawa, the Trudeau government is struggling to straddle a conflict causing bitter divisions far from the combat. Marina von Stackelberg reports.
Candles are lit under freezing rain outside of Ottawa's National Holocaust Monument, marking tomorrow's day to commemorate victims of the Nazi genocide. In attendance, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
And I will dwell in the house of the
Lord. He has yet to weigh in on the ruling from the International Court of Justice. Israel's ambassador to Canada, Ida Moed, was asked if this will change what his country's military is doing.
We have been conducting our actions according to the rule of law and according to the international law, according to international humanitarian law. This is what we've been doing and this is what we'll continue to do.
In a statement, Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, Melanie Joly, says that Canada's support for the UN's highest court, quote, does not mean that we accept the premise of the case. She says Canada supports Israel's right to defend itself and is also deeply concerned about the damage being done in Gaza.
I can only say my position has been clear.
Meanwhile, Liberal MPs are weighing in, including Anthony Housefather.
My position has been that Israel is not committing genocide, that it's baseless and it's insulting.
Liberal MP Salma Zahid recently returned from a trip to the West Bank.
It's incumbent on Canada to convince Israel to make sure that they follow what has been said in regards to making sure that civilians are protected, in regards to making sure that humanitarian aid can get in there.
NDP leader Jagmeet Singh also wants Canada to urge Israel to comply with the temporary measures, while the opposition Conservatives say they won't comment on the ruling today. Richard Robertson is with B'nai B'rith Canada, a Jewish advocacy group.
We'd like for Canada to take a position that supports the Israeli state as it continues its operations in Gaza.
Stephen Brown is with the National Council of Canadian Muslims.
We really welcome the court's decision, the court's ruling, insofar as it said that Israel is not doing enough to prevent a genocide in Gaza.
Where Canada should be concerned, in my view, is the fact that this case is proceeding.
Mark Kirsten is an expert in the investigation of international crimes.
International Court of Justice may determine in a year or a couple from now that Israel has committed genocide in Gaza. And if it does so, that may quite clearly implicate Canada, because Canada is selling military weapons and technology to the Israeli military.
That final decision could be years away. In the meantime, this ruling obliges all signatories, including Canada, to take actions now to protect Palestinian civilians. Marina von Stackelberg, CBC News, Ottawa.
Part of the ICJ's ruling calls for more humanitarian aid for Palestinians in Gaza. But today, one of the main organizations that fulfills that role is under renewed scrutiny. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA, fired some of its employees. The move comes in the wake of accusations by Israel those workers assisted in the October 7th Hamas attack. Richard Madden reports.
In war-torn Gaza, UNRWA is one of the largest providers of life-saving aid to Palestinians. But now, stunning revelations from the agency itself. Its Commissioner General, Philippe Lazzarini, confirmed in a statement several workers have been fired, accused by Israel of being involved in the deadly terror attacks by Hamas when the war began on October 7th. Top UN spokesperson Stefan Duzaric says an investigation is now underway.
The Secretary General is horrified by this news. We need to investigate this matter swiftly and to ensure that any UNRWA employee shown to have participated or abetted in what transpired on October 7th or in any other criminal activity be terminated immediately and referred for potential criminal prosecution.
Israel has long accused UNRWA, which runs many social programs in the Gaza Strip, of fueling anti-Semitism, accusations the agency denies. But these latest claims and quick actions by UNRWA signal these accusations are serious, threatening not only the credibility of the agency, but the UN itself. Israel's ambassador to the UN reacted with anger.
The UN is not only weaponized to delegitimize our existence, but also to physically exterminate us.
This announcement comes hours after the UN's top court ordered Israel to take measures to prevent acts of genocide in Gaza. Here in Washington, where the U.S. is one of UNRWA's largest donors, the State Department announced it's halted funding to the agency. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on the U.N. Secretary General to conduct a thorough, transparent, and swift investigation. At the White House, National Security spokesperson John Kirby went a step further.
It is a U.N. agency, and yes, we have contributed to their work, and that work has been meaningful, and it has been important in places like Gaza. But we also are willing to hold them accountable for this particular incident and before the alleged behavior. I think it's about a dozen employees were assisting Hamas, and even to the point of maybe even, you know, involved in hostage taking, then absolutely they need to be held to account.
Canada has provided more than $200 million in aid to UNRWA since 2016, restoring the funding cuts by the previous Harper government. But late today, a reversal. International Development Minister Ahmad Hussein said Canada has now paused additional funding to UNRWA going forward. UNRWA is one of Gaza's largest employers. Its funding supports schools, health, and food assistance. Since the war began, it's played a critical role overseeing the distribution of vital supplies. But to many aid groups, the concern now is how will Gaza's desperate citizens receive them if UNRWA's funding is reduced or eliminated? Richard Madden, CBC News, Washington.
A jury in New York has awarded writer E. Jean Carroll more than $83 million U.S. in her defamation suit against former President Donald Trump. She sued Trump for repeatedly defaming her when calling her sexual abuse allegations against him a con job. Last year, a jury found Trump did sexually abuse her in 1996. Earlier today, Trump walked out of the courtroom in a huff shortly before the jury started deliberations. After the verdict, Trump posted on social media the case was politically motivated, and he will appeal. Coming right up, batteries won, trees nothing. Details of the court fight over a facility linked to the future of electric vehicles. Plus, BC does what it can to unplug smartphones from the lives of students. Later, we have this tangy treat.
In a few short years, pickleball has gone from obscurity to one of the fastest growing sports in Canada.
I've never seen a sport sort of enter the cultural conversation like pickleball has in the last couple years.
But rapid growth has the sport in a pickle. There are not enough places to play. I'm Jamie Strachan in Toronto with an innovative solution to give players more brine time. That story coming up on The World at 6.
A big loss in court today for the environmental movement in Quebec, and a big win for the largest private investment ever in the province's history. The request to stop preparatory work at the site of a new EV battery plant east of Montreal was soundly rejected. Alison Northcott has more on the decision.
There were no sounds of machinery at the future site of Northvolt's electric vehicle battery plant this morning. Work has been at a standstill since last week, awaiting today's court decision.
We are concerned, of course, for the environmental impact.
A Quebec environmental group and three citizens asked the court to halt tree clearing at the site, arguing the work authorizations issued to the Swedish company were unreasonable and failed to ensure the protection of the area's wetlands and at-risk species. In his decision, the judge said their arguments did not meet the high bar required for an injunction. But Marc Bichai, lawyer for the Quebec Environmental Law Center, says they're not giving up their fight.
So we will continue to see what we can do in order to have more transparency, more public participation.
Lawyers for Northvolt told the court delaying the work would be fatal for the company, compromising a project they argued is in the public's interest. In a statement this afternoon, Northvolt said there was serious study and numerous strict conditions fulfilled to obtain its permits, and said it would resume its work at the site immediately. The federal and provincial governments have committed billions to Northvolt's Quebec plant, calling it the biggest private investment in Quebec ever. The 170-hectare project will stretch across two communities, but it never went through the province's usual environmental public hearings because the rules were changed shortly before Northvolt's application.
From here all the way to Saint-Basile-le-Grand over there.
Some residents in the area, like Simon Bouchard, are demanding more transparency.
It's for the government to do independent work to evaluate the project from the economics and social and environmental aspects.
There are mounting tensions around the project. An anonymous group said it aimed to sabotage Northvolt's work by driving nails and steel bars into trees to damage equipment. And the Mohawk Council of Ganawagi has filed a separate lawsuit alleging the provincial and federal governments failed in their duty to consult. Ross Montour is a council chief.
Well, they never talked to us about it. He never talked to us about what our concerns would be with the project.
Former Quebec Environment Minister Daniel Breton now heads Electric Mobility Canada, an industry association. He says Quebec made mistakes that other jurisdictions can learn from.
To me, it doesn't make sense that the government would say that this is the largest private project in the history of Quebec, and then would say, well, it's not big enough for us to have to go through a consultation.
The Quebec government says it will continue to defend the project.
For me, this is a flagship project.
While in Ottawa, Federal Innovation Minister François-Philippe Champagne says Northvolt's project will anchor Quebec in the green economy, and he's happy it can now move forward. Alison Northcott, CBC News, Montreal.
The U.S. is pausing approvals of permits to export liquefied natural gas to countries where it doesn't have trade deals. A White House statement says the process doesn't adequately account for the impact of greenhouse gas emissions. Canadian producers have expressed concerns about the move because the market between the two countries is intertwined. It could also affect Europe and Asia, which have tapped American LNG to replace the supply from Russia. If you've got a teen or preteen in your house, you know it's almost impossible to tear them away from their smartphone. Harder still, to protect them from what can happen on social media. But today, the province of BC announced plans to help by restricting cell phone use in schools. But more importantly, it's launching a new service to get help from the justice system if someone is threatened online. Lindsay Duncombe has the details.
We're going to try and get through this, guys.
Telling his son's story isn't easy. At a news conference with BC's Premier, Ryan Cleland explained how his 12-year-old son Carson was approached online by someone pretending to be a girl his age. Carson shared intimate images with the account.
And they threatened Carson. They wanted gift cards, money, anything. And if he didn't give them, they were going to share his pictures with anybody on his friends list.
Hours later, Carson tried to kill himself. Doctors couldn't save him.
And we had to take Carson off life support. We held him in our arms until he took his last breath and passed away. We stand here today as two broken parents trying to do everything to make sure this doesn't happen to another family, to another child, to another person.
Cleland spoke at a news conference ahead of the implementation of BC's Intimate Images Protection Act, which goes into effect Monday. The Civil Act attempts to make it easier to get intimate images taken down from social media sites. It covers near-nude images, videos, live streams, and digitally altered images known as deepfakes. Under the Act, companies can be fined and victims can seek compensation. BC Premier David Eby.
Can you imagine any other situation in our society where an environment is set up for kids, where a stranger is able to walk in, take pictures of a child, threaten their safety, and the person who is providing that space, the company that is providing that space, says, we have no responsibility here.
BC is the ninth province to enact such legislation. The province announced it in conjunction with a plan to restrict cell phone use in schools and a commitment to take social media companies to court over dangerous or harmful posts. Not easy tasks, according to privacy lawyer Claire Feltrin, who helped advise the government's policy.
Third-party platforms are notoriously difficult to contact.
Sextortion cases are especially tough to go after because perpetrators are often in a different country. Maura Gossman is a computer science professor at the University of Waterloo.
So if they're in Turkey or Iceland or wherever, they're not subject to being held in front of court here in Canada.
One of the biggest challenges in sextortion cases, getting kids embarrassed and scared to share what's happening to them. For them, Carson's mom, Nicholas Smith, had this message.
Asking these three words are probably the hardest thing you'll ever do in your life. But it is life-changing for you and for your loved ones. I need help.
Lindsay Duncombe, CBC News, Vancouver.
CBC News has learned multiple murder charges against accused killer Kenneth Law will be upgraded. The Ontario man will face 14 first-degree charges. That's in addition to charges of abetting suicide in connection with multiple deaths across the province. Law is also linked to dozens more deaths overseas. Thomas Dagg broke this story and has reaction from one of the alleged victims' families.
Constantemente.
Maria Lopez takes strength from the necklace she wears with a picture of her beloved only child. Jesenia Badoija Lopez from Aurora, Ontario, died in September 2022. She was only 18 years old. Now, Jesenia is listed in court documents as one of the 14 alleged murder victims of Kenneth Law.
To me, my daughter was, in addition to being my friend, my confidant. She was everything.
Maria and her husband, Leonardo Badoija, spoke to CBC News through an interpreter about their deep grief.
Every day, instead of feeling better, every day we feel worse.
Families around the world blame Law for their pain. Investigators say the 58-year-old operated websites selling a toxic salt and other items for self-harm. He sent packages to buyers in more than 40 countries, including the U.S., France, and Australia. Now, in Law's home province, the former hotel cook is facing upgraded charges, 14 counts of first-degree murder and 14 counts of counseling or aiding suicide in connection with deaths across Ontario.
It's quite the legal minefield to get through.
Ingrid Grant is a criminal defense lawyer in Toronto. She points out for a first-degree murder conviction, unlike second-degree murder, prosecutors must show the homicide was not only deliberate but planned. And Grant says that's not straightforward in this case.
I've never heard of anyone being charged with first-degree murder for assisting a suicide, essentially.
Neither police nor Crown attorneys provided any explanation today for the upgraded charges. Still, the prosecution's new approach was welcomed by the father of one alleged victim. Stephen Mitchell Sr. from Toronto told CBC News the upgraded charges, in his words, match the crimes that Law committed against my son and many others. Across multiple continents, no fewer than 124 deaths are suspected of being connected to Law's products. As for Maria Lopez, she says she wants justice for her daughter.
Yo personalmente espero que...
Personally, I hope that the person who caused all this bears the full weight of the law.
Law has been in custody since his arrest last May. He's scheduled to appear in court next Tuesday. And his lawyer says when given the chance, Law intends to plead not guilty. Thomas Dagg, CBC News, Toronto.
This is The World at 6 for just a little bit longer. I'm Tom Harrington. You see, beginning next week, a slight change in harmony with our times. We'll be your world tonight. You'll still find us right here at 6 p.m. on CBC Radio with the same mission to bring you the best of CBC journalism, but with a stronger presence in the podcasting world. That all begins Monday, January 29th. Raise your hand if you don't yet know what pickleball is. Just checking, because we're getting to the point where news stories about the sport are going to stop explaining what it is. A mix of tennis, ping pong, and badminton. There, you're caught up. There are millions of pickleball players who don't need an explainer, but they do need a place to play. The sport is growing so fast, it's outgrowing the number of facilities available. Jamie Strachan now on the sport's new frontiers.
Mike Livy, manager of the Progress Pickleball Club in Scarborough, has a problem. Too many players and not enough courts. The club's courts are housed in an old hockey arena whose full-time tenant is actually a badminton club.
The badminton club takes three quarters of the time. We only have 8 to 12 Monday to Friday. It's really not enough time.
Finding space to play is an issue across the country for a sport that until a few years ago few had even heard of. In 2023, Pickleball Canada now estimates about a million people play it at least once a month.
It's such a social game, and you get to meet people. It's a very easy game to play. It's an extremely hard game to play well, but it's an easy game to play.
Fast forward to 2003, and Pickleball Canada estimates now about a million people play at least once a month. The game is like a miniature version of tennis played with paddles and a harder, less bouncy ball, and has been especially attractive to older athletes, like 93-year-old club regular Vivian Wong.
Well, you get a lot of exercise, like you can get out the house, and meet a lot of nice people here, some really nice people. Every time I hit a nice shot, you know, I feel good about it.
There is an effort to create more space while at the same time making the game more appealing to all ages. It's leading to some creative solutions.
I've never seen a sport sort of enter the cultural conversation like pickleball has in the last couple years.
Drummond Munro, the co-founder of Fairgrounds, is at Cloverdale Mall in suburban Toronto. He's standing in a vast retail space that used to house Target. All around him, workers are feverishly installing 9 new pickleball courts. Fairgrounds is partnering with a number of malls in the GTA and Vancouver to breathe life into dormant spaces and give people another incentive to visit the mall.
There's definitely a supply and demand opportunity right now with pickleball in general. It's winter. Where are people playing pickleball outside of the YMCAs? We've heard church basements converting. This is just going to fit what people are looking for right now.
There will be no membership fees. Players will pay by the hour. The courts will be part of a design space that will include a restaurant and bar. Fairgrounds marketing director Monica Mann says they want to shake up the sport.
For me, I think a perfect night is having all the courts full. I think the music blasting. I think people laughing.
A chance for an emerging sport to continue growing while revitalizing unused space and giving people more places to play. Jamie Strachan, CBC News, Toronto.
Finally tonight, we hope you'll excuse us for talking about ourselves. This is, after all, the final edition of The World at Six. The first one, 57 years ago, arrived in Canadian households sounding like this.
Good evening. This is The World at Six. From CBC News Toronto, this is Bruce Rogers, and here are the headlines.
October 31st, 1966, a new program with an ambitious goal of bringing in-depth and immediate journalism in a broad half-hour format to you, or your parents, or your grandparents. You get the idea. News that delivered on a public service mandate. Through generations here on the program, that mission has been unwavering. And although The World at Six will be no more after today, we're really not going anywhere. We're changing the name. We're adopting a sharper focus on podcasting. You can listen at 6 or at 9:30 or the next morning. That choice will be yours. But of course, we'll still be right here for you at 6, 6:30 in Newfoundland on radio every evening. We're teaming up with our colleagues at The World This Weekend to bring you Your World Tonight, 7 days a week, same time as always. And we invite you to check out the podcast, which will give you the day's top stories in a tighter package. Our goal is to have that available daily at around 6 o'clock Eastern Time. Your World Tonight debuts on Monday. We hope you'll join us for the best in CBC News journalism. This has been The World at 6 for nearly 21,000 days. I'm still Tom Harrington. Thanks for listening tonight and every night. We'll talk to you Monday. Stay safe and take care of each other.